yet we may be granted intimations of that music, in dreams. Here's Milton, but else in deep of night, when drowsiness hath locked up mortal sense, then listen I to the celestial siren's harmony, that sit upon the nine enfolded spheres and sing. The heavenly tune, which none can hear of human mould with gross unpurged ear. 17. The spheres. Just open a porthole, hold your breath, stick your head into space, and enjoy. Get your hosts to give you a message, an urgent communication to be delivered to mankind. Message giving used to be routine. Today it's often neglected, by space people who act more like tourists than benefactors. But if you prod them, they'll come up with a few stern injunctions, to stop waging war, polluting the atmosphere, wearing furs, etc. Sit your space person down. Fetch him a goblet of nectar, to get him going. Let him see from your sober expression that you're a serious, competent sort, someone he can trust to faithfully record and deliver his message. Now write down everything he says. Try to get him to make his points clearly and succinctly. If there's something you don't understand, now's the time to. 18. Speak up, not when you're back on Earth, watching the saucer disappear into the sky. Urge him to avoid clichés. Good luck, when he's finished, thank him in behalf of humanity. Sound sappy, I know, but do it. Say, thank you, sir, in behalf of humanity, and you've got yourself a message. If you've been abducted by space aliens, you may still be able to get a message. They occasionally give them out. Betty Andreessen, for example, brought back the following message from Kwasga, conveyed to her in his native tongue. O tukra bahach uta mohula da duwa mahad a o katarat nu lahan tutra o honomarakoto tutra etra me ekotutra etro indra grila. Andreessen had no idea what this meant, she was simply repeating it, she said. Quoted in Fowler, The Andreessen Affair. Discreetly pocket some small object, food pill, bar of soap, chunk of antimatter from the propulsion system, as a memento. Your grandchildren may someday ask you, Gramp, is it true you once rode in a flying saucer? You can nod slowly, show them this memento, gaze wistfully into the sky, and murmur, yeah, I rode one. And you know what? If they came back tonight, I'd do it again. 19. Dated. Ignore their brusque manners and forbidding looks. That kind of behavior is their problem, not yours. Do what they tell you, after all, you have fallen into their clutches. But try to maintain your dignity, equanimity, and good humor. You'll soon be done with this nonsense and headed home. The aliens will give you a medical examination. It can take anywhere from a few minutes to an hour. When it's over, tell them you wish to see the results. Insist on this. It's your legal right. Have the doctor in charge, the tall one with the clipboard, show you his notes and explain them to you. He'll speak no English, but you can communicate via telepathy or gestures. If a problem is indicated, get a second opinion. Yes, that will mean another examination, by another impersonal team of aliens. But it's worth it. And you're an old hand by now at being examined. The original diagnosis will probably be confirmed. At that point, insist upon immediate treatment, and at their expense. If they start to frown, shake their heads, and cackle like geese, point out that you didn't ask to be here, but that as long as you are, you're their responsibility. Luzinstag was drinking coffee with Adamski, when he reached into his pocket and brought out a crystalline stone, wrapped in a silk cloth. The stone was from Venus, he said, smiling broadly. He let her handle it, and explained that his space friends had given it to him. 20. If abducted by space aliens, refuse to be intimate, the point is to make the most of a distressing situation. Obnoxious as they are, the space aliens represent a technologically advanced race. Their diagnostic equipment and medical procedures are far superior to our own. So take advantage. While waiting to be examined, abductees have noted the presence of other humans in the room, lying on tables or standing in glass capsules. If possible, go over and strike up a conversation with these people. They're as bewildered and apprehensive as you, and will welcome any human contact. Your conversation could go something like this: Why, hi there. G:hi. Why, this is bizarre, ain't it? G:I'll say. Why, been here long? G:too long. Why, I hear you, pal. Hang in there. 21. G:you too. Why, okay, better get back to my table. Here they come. An abductee with drawing skills? Do portraits of the aliens, and let them have these as gifts. They'll appreciate the gesture and treat you better. 22. On a ship belonging to those party horn-nosed aliens? Join them in a jam session. You'll have a ball. 23. Gee, those are some ways in which to profit from your flying saucer experience, while still aboard. But you can continue to reap benefits after returning to Earth. Remember how Adamski and the others turned their encounters into both personal advantage and public service? You can, too. Here are my suggestions for doing so. Bring back a new food, something super nutritious, easy to grow, and tasty, and market it. You can make a profit, while rendering a service to humanity. Look at Howard Menger and his moon potato. It had 6 times the nutrients of an ordinary potato. 24. Though limited to a few notes, the fellows are able to produce some expressive sounds on their noses. One group of them is said to appear regularly at a jazz club in San Francisco. Bring back a new material and develop it commercially. Don't make the same mistake as William Denton, a New England spiritualist. Members of Denton's family traveled to Mars via astral projection. He describes their voyages in The Soul of Things, or Psychometric Research and Discoveries, self-published, 1873. There they learned about aluminum, which the Martians used extensively. But Denton failed to follow up on this discovery. He made a modest living as author and lecturer, leaving the commercial introduction of the metal, in 1886, to others. Come back with proof that you rode in a flying saucer. A jumpsuit, a goblet, a photograph of the space people, you could win one of the cash awards offered periodically to anyone with evidence that the Earth is being visited by extraterrestrials. The National Enquirer had a standing offer of $1 million for positive proof of flying saucers, while Archbunker Philip Klass offered $10,000 to any abductee whose story was repeated to, and confirmed by, the FBI, and be sure to sign an affidavit attesting to your experience. While not proof of anything, such a document, properly notarized, will enhance your claim. That message the space people gave you? Write it up and publish it. As a leaflet, a pamphlet, a book, whatever. The point is to get it to the public. If the prospect of being a messenger is daunting, consider the case of Daniel Fry. While living in New Mexico, Fry had several contacts with an extraterrestrial named Alan, or Alan, as Fry called him. Finally, Alan asked him, "Dan, how much longer are you going to hide your light under a bushel?" Fry was unfamiliar with the biblical allusion. So Alan explained that when you light a candle, you don't hide it under a bushel basket. You put it on a candlestick, that everyone may benefit from the light. Alan went on, 25. 26. 27. We have expended considerable time and patience in the effort to light a few candles among the races of your planet. It has been our hope that the light of these candles might grow in brilliance until it exposed the terrible abyss toward which the peoples of your world are so blindly rushing. We have given you information which is both of interest and of value to your people. Why do you keep it to yourself? But what can I do? I am unknown. How can I reach the public, and who would listen if I could? Those who are not blind to truth will recognize the value of the message, regardless of who the messenger may be. Write what you have learned from us in a book. Tell the story through your newspapers, your radio and television stations, and if necessary, shout it from the housetops, but let the people know. Fry took this exhortation to heart. He wrote several books, founded Understanding Unlimited, and lectured around the world. He also made more than 1,000 radio and television appearances. Don't let the space people down. Remember, you are the messenger. scrawled in your notebook is that communication of theirs, that urgent message for mankind. Yes, it's rambling, vapid, and cliché-ridden. But it's what they wanted to say, and what you agreed to deliver. So, what are you waiting for? Give it a name like Celestials or the Jupiter Deli or She Andromeda. The menu could be shaped like a flying saucer. Wear your jumpsuit and greet customers at the door. Install a universal energy accumulator in your home, and save up to 100% on utility bills. Daniel Fry, Allen's Message, to Men of Earth, New Age, 1954. 28. Open a restaurant with an outer space theme. 29. The space people use a toothbrush with an advanced design. Ask for one during your stay, and bring it back to Earth. Then reproduce and market it as the Astro Brush. 30. Ryan Holdschmidt noticed that the coffee served aboard the saucer was MJB brand. But he failed to follow up on this. He could have approached the coffee company and offered to do a commercial. Scene: Ryan Holdschmidt is seated in the lounge of a flying saucer, sipping on a beverage. Enter Firkin, an extraterrestrial. S. Say, Firkin, this is excellent. What is it, a type of nectar? F. No, just coffee. S. Oh. Then it won't help me to levitate. F. Laughs, I'm afraid not. But it'll give you a lift. 31. In the morning, or whenever you need one. S. What brand do you use? F. MJB. S. Is that available on Earth? F. Oh yes. S. MJB. I'll look for it. Frowns, sure would like to levitate, though. F. Try the nectar. Look for a product tie-in, and go after it. If you are a contactee who attends high school, how about a science fair project inspired by your experience? 32. Design and market a line of cosmic clothes. You could sell fluorescent jumpsuits, caps with antennae, sneakers called the Glide. Or simply lend your name to such a line. 33. Support groups for abductees have been springing up everywhere. Join one. You'll find out how others are coping with, or better yet, making the most of, their experience. You may spot a familiar face at one of these meetings. It's that guy on the next table, with whom you chatted while awaiting your medical exam. Go over, clap him on the back, and reminisce, why, it was all so unreal. G:, I'll say. Why? Did you get the tall one with the clipboard? G:, sure did. Know what I said to him? Why, what? G:, I said, Baldy, do what you have to. 34. Do. But get it over with and let me out of here. He just kinda cocked his head and started making these clucking sounds. And it dawns on me he doesn't speak any English. Right? So I start singing. I go, Jeepers, creepers. Where do ya get those peepers? Jeepers, creepers. Where do ya get those eyes? Gosh'll get up. How'd they get so lit up? Gosh'll get up. How'd they get that size? Why, hoo-hoo. G:, hope I never see that clown again. Or any of them. Why, it was like a bad dream. G:, tell me about it. Comma by Johnny Mercer and Harry Warren. Copyright 1938, renewed, Warner Brothers Incorporated. All rights reserved, used by permission. Miami, Florida 33014. 35. Conduct workshops in the extraterrestrial glide. And start a new life. Change your name to something like Orlan or Xantar or Fromalex. Friends may go on calling you Jim or Lisa. That's okay, so long as it's understood that you've undergone a transformation. That you've grown into a new, cosmically conscious individual. Write a book, give lectures, conduct workshops, appear on talk shows, start an organization, go around with a signboard. Anything, just don't keep your light under a bushel. 36. Upon your return to Earth, take on a space name. 37. Gee, it could be only a matter of time before you get taken aboard a UFO. If so, I hope these suggestions prove helpful. Yet feel free to improvise with ideas of your own. Every flying saucer experience is unique. So do some brainstorming and figure out how to benefit from your particular experience. But my point is this, don't just have a flying saucer experience. Of that experience, it could be a golden opportunity to undergo personal transformation, empower yourself, and prosper. And maybe even do some good while you're at it. Things to beware: don't let a misadventure mar your encounter. Here are a few things to beware. 1. Hot holes. When Daniel Fry first approached a flying saucer, a voice rang out from a loudspeaker, "Better not touch the hull, pal, it's still hot." Passing through the atmosphere causes friction, which generates heat. So resist that impulse to touch the saucer. 2. Spontaneous levitation. Frank Edwards, in Flying Saucers, Serious Business, Lyle Stewart, 1966, mentions a contactee who experienced levitation. Unexpectedly and uncontrollably. Should you feel it coming, grab onto something. 3. Getting lost. If you visit a mothership, be careful. With their endless, identical corridors, these colossal craft are easy to get lost in. The best advice is to stay with your guide. Don't wander off in search of a soda machine. At risk, a flying saucer experience can happen to anyone. No one is exempt, not even skeptics. However, certain people are more likely than others to have an encounter, and should be especially prepared. Are you one of these at-risk types? Let's find out. Ufologist John Keel examined and analyzed more than 10,000 UFO reports for North America. He found that, 1. Most sightings are reported by Protestants, Jewish and Catholic percipients, says Keel, R.A. 2. Gypsies and Native Americans have a higher rate of sightings and contacts than the general population. 3. So do left-handed, blonde-haired, and red-haired people. 4. The majority of abductees are male. They tend to be young, outdoor types. 5. Percipients and contactees tend to have unusual names, Bether or Moore Van Tassel, say, as opposed to Smith or Jones. 6. Many school teachers have reported seeing UFOs. Are they a sharp-eyed lot? Or are their students simply driving them nuts? This could be explained demographically by pointing out that most sightings occur in rural areas, which tend to be Protestant. But isn't that begging the question? What drew the saucers, the location or its inhabitants? That is to say, are rural areas attractive because they are rural, isolated, or because they are Protestant? Interestingly, lapsed Catholics see UFOs as often as Protestants do. Again, the demographic argument would be that lapsed Catholics gravitate, for some sociological reason, to rural areas. But that seems unlikely. Something more profound may be at work here. Skeptics, of course, will argue that rural inhabitants have simply preserved a venerable American tradition, the tall tale. 7. Policemen and night watchmen often spot UFOs. This is probably due to their being active at night prime time for sightings, and watchful. Barbers and auto mechanics, day workers who focus on what is directly in front of them, are rarely percipients, and I would add a finding of my own. For some reason, men whose first name is George are contacted out of proportion to their numbers in society. Consider the following: George Adamski and George Van Tassel were among the earliest, and most notable, contactees. George Hunt Williamson was that associate of Adamski's who made radio contact with extraterrestrials. George King was a London cab driver who began to receive telepathic communications from Venusians. He founded the Aetherius Society, still active in Los Angeles. Dr. George Marlowe, director of a shadowy organization called UFO Research, claimed to have been on the spaceships known as flying saucers more times than most of the contactees of this world. Dr. George Wilkins was involved with saucers and pyramid power. See the pyramid hat, there are others. What does it mean? Evidently, if your name is George, you stand a good chance of being contacted. Don't ask me why. But the fact remains, it can happen to anyone. So be prepared. Keel presents these findings in The People Problem, in Phenomenon, 40 Years of Flying Saucers, edited by John Spencer and Hilary Evans, Avon, 1988. Skeptics will insist that this apparent favoring of George's is an illusion. They will argue that such conjunctions are due to coincidence and a biased selection of data, and that the mystery tends to vanish after an informed calculation of the probabilities involved. For an introduction to the laws of probability, see Chapter 7 of George Gamow's 123.Infinity, Viking Press, 1947. Three special words. The first moments of an encounter are usually the most challenging. As that space person beckons you aboard, or that ray draws you up, or those little men carry you off in their net, it's not easy to keep a cool head. One is more likely to start sputtering with anxiety. So I want to give you three special words to use during the initial phase of your encounter. I call them the UFO words. They are Yiddish, and have been time-tested in problematical situations. These words are meant to be pronounced aloud and with feeling. They'll help to express emotion, dissolve tension, and promote an acceptance of what is happening to you. To summon them up, simply think of the letters UFO. U is for unglück, meaning unlucky me. F is for fartootst exclamation mark or roughly, I'm discombobulated. And O is for oi, as in oi. I don't believe this is happening to me. Unglück. Fartootst. Oi. Use as needed, singly or together, as your encounter unfolds. Isaac Bashevis the singer has described Yiddish as the language of us all. The idiom of frightened and hopeful humanity. 6. Q&A. Q&A. In this section I shall try to answer some questions that are commonly asked in regard to flying saucers and outer space. Gee, is there really a giant happy face on Mars? Yes, and not just according to contactees. It has been photographed by exclamation mark skeptics attribute the face to random fractures caused by a meteor impact. But close examination of the photo leaves little doubt that this is a monument, built by Martians. / Close examination will also reveal a UFO, passing over the monument. Look to the right of the smile. I have noticed that many UFO experiences begin while the person is in bed, asleep. Doesn't this imply that the experience is merely a dream? Not at all. For some reason, both the space people and the space aliens prefer to conduct their encounters at night. Probably for secrecy's sake, since most of us are asleep at night, it stands to reason that the majority of encounters will involve sleeping individuals. Gee, are there any psychological benefits from simply being aboard a saucer? Contactees have reported a sense of well-being that lasted for weeks after their return to Earth. This mild euphoria could be a result of exposure to the space people's philosophy, a reaction to cosmic radiation, which space travelers absorb at a high rate, or simply the lingering effects of nectar. Gee, I'd like to take a ride in a flying saucer, but only if it's one of the space people's. No way with those bug-eyed creeps. My question is, how can I tell the difference, so that when a saucer lands, I'll know whether to approach it or run? As a general rule, saucers belonging to the space people are silver-hued and silent. Those of the space aliens, on the other hand, are usually reddish, make a hissing or whining sound, and smell like burning rubber. So if it smells funny or makes a noise, skedaddle. Gee, what determines who gets selected to be a contactee? It varies. A milkman in Sydney, Australia, contacted while making his morning rounds, asked the spacemen why they had chosen him. They replied that it had to do with his aura. George Adamski asked himself the same question, and decided it didn't matter. I found myself wondering, he writes in Inside the Spaceships, why I had been singled out to receive this friendship and been given this knowledge by men from other worlds. Whatever the reason, I felt very humble, and very grateful. Gee, is it true a second monument has been discovered on Mars, this one of the Sphinx? Yes, it too has been photographed by . Though eroded by time, the features of a Sphinx are clearly discernible. The happy face expresses the utopian side of Martian civilization, whereas the Sphinx reveals their sense of the ineluctable enigma of human existence. / In the ironic view of one of Adamski's detractors, He was chosen because his philosophy of life was so similar to that advocated by the space people. Hablo Espanol. No Hablo Ingles. Inverted question mark podría comunicarme con la gente del espacio? Person ser muy hablador, pero si impren Ingles. I am Spanish speaking. I have no English. Will I be able to communicate with the space people? They seem to be very talkative, but always in English. Don't worry, the space people are accomplished linguists. Consider this case. On August 23, 1965, some students in Mexico City were given a ride in a spaceship from Ganymede. According to the students, the occupants of the ship communicated with them in fluent Spanish, and claimed to speak more than 700 terrestrial languages. And back in the 50s, Salvador Villanueva Medina, a taxi driver who has been called the Mexican Adamski, had no problem in palavering with a ship full of extraterrestrials. Some of the ships reported over Mexico have been described as sombrero-shaped. These could be instances of a Jungian archetype, the circle that represents order and wholeness, manifest in visions that are culturally bound. Speaking of archetypes, it is conceivable that Adamski, if he was a fraud, was nonetheless in touch with the collective unconscious, via his imagination. Thus, he was indeed an instrument for the manifestation of meaningful archetypes. Can I take my car with me on the ship? Apparently so, Reinhold Schmidt did. He drove his 58 Buick up a ramp, and it accompanied him to the North Pole. Although he had no occasion to use it there, or at the Great Pyramid, his next stop, Schmidt was spared the worry of leaving it parked alongside a lonely road. On the other hand, you may have to take your vehicle with you. Consider the case of Penny Harper, editor of a UFO newsletter. Harper was driving along a Los Angeles freeway, when, to her delight, she had been avid for an encounter. She and her van were tractor beamed aboard a ship from the Pleiades. Gee, does one need a high school diploma to serve as a messenger for the space people? Of course not, anyone can be selected. As contactee Kelvin Rowe pointed out, I am quite without what is conventionally called education. Gee, during my first meeting with the space people, is there any special etiquette or protocols to observe? I don't want to offend them with my primitive ways. Contrary to their image as aloof, superior beings, the space people are friendly and informal. Just be yourself. Gee, do you shake hands with the space people, or what? In 1954, Dick Miller of Ann Arbor, Michigan, took a ride in a ship from Alpha Centauri. He reports, the man seated at the circular desk in the center of the room seemed to finish his particular duties, and then got up and walked toward me. He raised his right arm and I thought he was going to shake hands. But he laid his open palm down on my left shoulder, which was evidently their form of greeting or salutation. I felt rather foolish with my hand sticking out in front of me to shake his, but he noticed my embarrassment and said in perfect English, "Please do not feel foolish, for we have a great deal to discuss." Then he motioned me to one of the chairs. George Adamski, on the other hand, has described a pressing of palms. Gee, do the space people have a sense of humor? There are indications that they do. For example, in the summer of 1983, Joyce Updike of Ovid, Colorado, sought to establish telepathic communication with them. She asked to be put in touch with Hatton, the record keeper of the Intergalactic Fleet or Space Command or whatever, explaining that she had forgotten his exact title. A space person responded and carried on a conversation with her. When it was over, he signed off, "This is Hatton of the Intergalactic Fleet or Space Command or whatever. You see, we enjoy a good laugh, too." And here's Buck Nelson's description of his first ride in a saucer. "I was told I could take the ship up, and to sit at the control panel. After I got the ship high into space, I was told I could play with the controls. Meanwhile they had put safety belts on all of us, which they told me was for the first time in 3 years. It was a good thing too, for I had the ship upside down and every which way. I punched every button I could see and turned every dial. I got results one way or the other from everything I touched. When I got the ship upside down, I got no help, only lots of laughs from the spacemen. Gee, what kind of exercise do the space people prefer? They do not exercise as such,